You had mentioned about if a point's brought up that could be used against them, they probably won't bring it up. But what if they do? How do you get... The only way you could use that case in the future would be if it were published. How do you get a case published if something comes up like that?
Well, first of all, the publishing is their option. That's their system. And they choose when and where to publish. And obviously, they don't publish things that work against their interests. But they will publish things that do favor their interests. So I have no answer for that. They've got complete control of the publishing system, unless you can find somewhere in their rules that allow for external enforcement on them. Yeah, there might be a rule. You know, a lot of times you study these things, you might be surprised what they have in there, but then they don't educate the attorneys about it or something. You know, there's a lot in law that all you have to do is start reading cases and you find all kinds of stuff that you didn't know was on your side. Yeah.
Yes, I was, in the little I know, I've come to believe that it's important to not let yourself get into the jurisdiction unknowingly.
Right.
And it sounds like you've given a partial answer to that question just now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Was that a full answer or is there more?
That's really it. I mean, you see, first of all, you have to have some rational reason why they do not have jurisdiction. But to enforce it, you have to do a counterclaim. You have to actually challenge it. You say, you guys exceeded your jurisdiction by doing this, and you have caused me an injury, and here's the price I want you to pay for doing that. This is the damages. Okay? And of course, you could ask for no damages. Instead, you simply could ask for a court order pushing them back onto their side of the fence. But whatever you ask for, that is what you do. You have to do a counterclaim. Or if there's no suit in progress, file an original claim against them. You know, you get a letter from the IRS, right away you start the suit process. You know, send a notice and demand, and then next thing is in the court when they fail to perform. Don't fool around with these guys. Best defense is a good offense. All right, so here you have, as I said before, we went through this claim and the format. So, are you guys listening? You know, you have a claim, but now here's a counterclaim, and I want you to see the format of a counterclaim. Here's the format in the caption. The People of the State of California, plaintiff versus Robert Melvin Anderson, defendant. That was the original caption on their lawsuit against Anderson. Okay? Now, Anderson turns around, and he sues them based on jurisdiction, challenging their jurisdiction. So, this becomes... Robert Melvin Anderson, counter plaintiff, versus the original, which is the People of the State of California. You can see down here, Complainer Doe, also known as People of the State of California, counter defendants. And in the upper right, you see where it says counterclaim for trespass and trespass on the case. Now, what he did was he named the original. The original complainer, the original plaintiff, he got named again. And this is a counterclaim against him. However, this is an original suit against all the others. So Federalista Credit Union, Landfinder North, Mountain Finder North, Greater City Bank, and so on, these are all first-time defendants. Because they are first-time defendants, they could counterclaim you. Okay? Anytime you name a brand-new defendant, he's got to be served just like it was a new lawsuit for that particular person, and he can counterclaim if he wishes, or answer, or whatever. So he has all the same rights that any defendant would have. On the other hand, the Complainer Doe, also known as People of the State of California, he was the original plaintiff. You're counterclaiming him. He cannot counterclaim your counterclaim. It stops with your counterclaim. He can answer it, but he can't counterclaim it, you see. So he already has one case against you. He can't have two. So that's how that works. And likewise, if the remaining defendants, if any of them files a counterclaim against you, you cannot put a second claim against them. You can only answer their claim. See how that works? So This is a difference. You'll notice that you take your counterclaim and you put it below theirs. And up at the top, where we have the originator, he's identified as a counter plaintiff here because he filed his suit second. Now, then in the body of the lawsuit, really, there's no difference between a claim and a counterclaim other than the titles of the people. You know, and a little difference in the body where you say you're naturally going to talk about how they filed a lawsuit against you, a lawsuit that was unjustified with, you know, without jurisdiction. You'll talk about that. So that'll be a little different.
Your only issue here is jurisdiction?
No. That is the first issue.
Oh, that first issue.
Can add all you want after it, but the first issue is jurisdiction. Why? Because when you come back with a challenge to their jurisdiction, if their jurisdiction is the issue, all proceedings in their side must stop until they prove their jurisdiction. Until they prove their jurisdiction, they have no authority to proceed.
You're suing on jurisdiction?
Yes.
False arrest and because they're ugly.
I'm suing, yes, but the one that's key is the jurisdiction. Because that's what stops them. You can sue on the other stuff, but that won't stop them. Because if the other stuff amounts to a countersuit rather than a counterclaim, it's the jurisdiction specifically which makes them stop. They have to answer that. If they don't answer it, they're proceeding without jurisdiction. It's an unproven point. See, they're only free to go as long as they're not challenged. As soon as you raise the point, hey, what's your authority? They have to say, well, our authority is such and such, such and such. They have to have some rational explanation. Well, they never do. Okay? The best they can do, like one judge told me, I raised it verbally. I said, what's your jurisdiction? He says, my robe. He actually said that.
Can you reiterate the difference between a countersuit and a counterclaim?
Well, a counterclaim with jurisdiction, it's actually part of the jurisdiction. That stops everything. A countersuit is when party A sues party B does a countersuit and sues party A, the judge pulls them all together, adds up both sides, it's possible for both sides to win. Okay, one sues for $1,000, the other sues for $2,500, the difference is $1,500, okay? So the one suing for $2,500, he wins. The one suing for $1,000, he wins. The difference is $1,500. So $1,500 goes from here to there. You know, the difference. That's the countersuit. Just the difference. Yes, sir.
What do you do when the judge does something like my jurisdiction is my robe? What's the claim?
Well, I was handling it verbally, which I shouldn't have. You know, I was not handling it. It was a stupid minor traffic case. You know, I didn't make a federal case out of it. So I just let it go. But it was interesting when I raised that question, that was a stupid comment.
My question is, in general terms, is what do you do when you get a rogue judge or a rogue anything?
Well, what do you do when a robber has a gun in your face and says, give me your money? Do you explain to him that it's illegal, that his mother wouldn't approve, and that it's immoral? You give him your money.
I have more chance against the robber than I would against the judge.
Well, yeah, but the point is you give him the money, okay? You can't do anything. You know, if somebody's bound to break the law, you don't have the guns. All right?
Exactly. They do.
Right. They do. So, and remember this. I said right at the get-go, right today, one of the first things I talked about is that be nice to these people because you're depending on them to enforce your judgments later. See? So don't be riling up these people unnecessarily. You take care of who you have to take care of, but you make sure all the others are friendly toward you who are not involved. You try to get the sheriff on your side or the deputies, you know. You're always a pleasant figure coming in. You know, they like you. You'd be surprised. They do things behind the scenes. I've seen judges turn around mysteriously. Why did they turn around? Well, we don't know. But I'll tell you something. They turned around. And I don't believe a leopard changes its spots. You know, they turned around, became very nice, In fact, I remember this one woman. She had a driver's license issue. The judge, she was in contention with the judge, and it was a contention. They hated each other. And the judge got promoted into a federal position, and while he was in the state, I think it was in the state judge, he ordered it transferred to the federal, made it a federal case, and then when he became the federal judge, he took the case. and then he did something, and she filed a lawsuit against him, and then he issued an order saying that she could not file any more papers in either case, either the original case or the case she had sued him where he was a defendant. So she filed another paper, I guess, objecting to that. So he sent the marshal out and arrested her for contempt of court, and he charged her with 2 counts of contempt because she had filed papers in both cases. And she did something like, I think it was 72 days in solitary, okay? And her son put together a habeas corpus and filed a habeas corpus in every possible court, Supreme Court, Appellate Court, and District Court on the federal side, Supreme Court, Appellate Court, and a state court there. So that was 6 of them. There was a 7th one too, I think, a circuit court, I guess they called it. And so on the 72nd day, the judge pulled her out. He had convicted her of 2 6-month consecutive sentences, all right? And so when she came back into jail, all of a sudden he was the most wonderful person you ever saw. I mean, he was just wonderful, a nice guy. And he says, Mrs. So-and-so, he says, you know, I think you've learned your lesson now. He says, I'm ordering you to be released and the record purged.
Is it your opinion that's because of the habeas corpuses that were filed?
Oh, of course. That's what turned him around. Somebody looked at this because we specifically named, you know, I helped her son, but we specifically named 6 Bill of Rights violations, okay? Absolute rights that this guy had overrun. It's just black and white, no question about it. Somebody up there said, we got a problem here. And they must have talked to him, see? But you don't know. I couldn't prove that. I'm just saying it.
Okay.
But that's, he released her. Now, she was really burned out with all those, you know, over 2 months of solitary. So, you know, she burned out. There was an attorney that contacted her and offered to push this because it made him mad just watching the procedures, how she got railroaded. And she didn't take him up on it. But he wanted to burn this judge for it. But that was really a wonderful judge. I mean, you would think that, and he was a tiger up until that point. Yeah.
Question:
It sounds like your response to what you get a rogue judge or whatever then is you say, okay, you've got round one, but the fight's not over with yet.
That's it. You, okay. In the short run, the robber always wins.
Okay.
Based on what you say of her being released upon the habeas corpus,
mm-hmm.
and in turn, was she able to come back and file a claim against the judge?
She got burned out. She didn't do it. She could have, but she didn't do it.
Assuming that she would have done it, would it have been conceivable to conceive that perhaps that she would have challenged him on his oath of office for violating the 6 Bill
of
Rights?
Who knows? I mean, that's all speculation.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I realize that.
Yeah, but obviously she had a case. I mean, here is a violation, a clear violation of constitutionally protected rights. But, you know, she didn't follow through. That was it. She was burned out. She, you know, spent enough time. She did her part. I don't blame her, you know. Time for a new soldier to step up and... Well, yeah, but you know,
no,
you know, if you've ever been to jail, it takes a lot out of you. You know, so I don't blame her for giving up. I wish she'd continued, but I understand it when she didn't. Okay. Anyway, this is a counterclaim. Now, the other thing is that we've been talking about California a lot, but in the fact is that there are other states that have other formats. So here's a very typical format that's used in other states. Okay? Same case, you might say. I mean, I just adapted this to the Florida format. But in Florida, they put the name of the court on line 1. Okay? And they put the venue on line 2, And on line 3, they show which division of the court in the county that this case is in. Then it's the plaintiff versus the defendants, and then the case number is on the right, and they had a division number. And then they put the name of the action, which normally in California you put under the case number. Here they put it as the first set of information under the defendants, and action for trespass on the case, verified, and then they draw a line under it, and that becomes the title of the paper. Then the rest of the paper is filled in with the normal stuff, just like we do here, and then they put the contact person, instead of being in the upper left corner, they put it at the bottom.
Oh, it's the very last thing.
Yeah, it's the very last thing. The contact person's on the last instead of the beginning.
Bill?
Yes.
Is a case number assigned, or do you fill that in and pen?
The case is always assigned by the clerk.
So you leave that blank and you fill it in?
Sure. When you file it, you give it, you handwrite the first one, or they have a stamp typically where they'll stamp it. They have some sort of machine that automatically advances the case numbers. As different courts have different systems. So, but yeah, you leave it blank when you initially put it together because you don't know what the case number is till you get there.
When you have a case all typed up and pretty, who do you hand it to?
Clerk.
You just hand it to him and say, here,
yeah.
I want to sue somebody?
That's right. You hand it to her. You say, I'm filing this case. Okay? They'll take the case. And then the next thing, once they've accepted the case, they'll give you a summons. And typically what they do, they give you one summons, it's certified, the name of the defendant is left blank. And then you take it to a copy machine, you copy that, and you fill in on each individual summons the name of one person that's being summoned. You put that with a copy of the lawsuit and you give it to them. And then on the summons, it explains exactly what they have to do. They have 30 days to answer and so on.
Okay. Oh, the court writes up the summons?
No. The clerk writes up a preliminary form and then puts her signature on it and certifies it with a seal. Okay? Because it's a court order. But you fill in the names.
Oh, and I'm responsible for getting this to...
Yes, you have to serve them with it.
Oh, I must... The court doesn't perform that service. I must...
You serve it. And you have to serve it according to the rules.
So I must find a process server and take it?
No. Anybody who's not connected with your case can serve it.
Oh.
Process server... Yeah. A process server... When you file a lawsuit... You take it to the window. The clerk assigns a case number. The clerk will give you... You should have a copy of the lawsuit. The clerk stamps that copy. That copy is now conformed. That's the word they use. It's conformed. You get the conformed copy back. The clerk keeps the original. Then the clerk will give you a summons. The summons is mostly filled out. The part that's missing is the defendant's name. You take that summons to a copy machine. If you have 10 defendants, you make 10 copies.
Oh, that summons will have the court date on it and
has all the information on it.
Oh.
So then you, and it has instructions to the defendant telling him what to do. So then you take one copy for each defendant with his own name on it and you serve. He gets a copy of the summons and he gets a copy of the complaint along with all the evidence. Copy of all the evidence. Then once you've served them, you have to make up a proof of service. And there's a specific form, and it's usually printed on the back of the summons. And so, on the back of each summons that you've made a copy of, you have whoever served the papers, could be the sheriff, could be a process server, could be a friend. But you have them fill it out, and you take that back to the clerk, and you file that copy of the summons. So you actually make two copies for each defendant. One to serve to him and one to give back to the clerk. Because it has to be certified that he was served. Okay?
Tell us about the serving of the paper. If
okay.
Do it in
yeah. Person. Yeah. I will get to that. Okay, so you've served them, and now you have to deliver the proof of service back to the clerk. Okay? Basic procedure. If you have any friends who are experienced in this, they'll tell you how to do it.
Cool, thanks.
Okay. Our main purpose here is to cover format. But I will go through the different kinds of service that you can do. The first service, the highest quality service, is where you have somebody who is not connected with the suit. Can be anybody over the age of 18 or older. That person delivers the summons and the lawsuit to whoever is being sued personally. Walks up to the person, "Are you so-and-so?" "Yes, I am." "This is a lawsuit. You are being sued." Man refuses to take it. Let go of it, drops on the floor. Walk off. He's been served. Don't worry about him taking it. He knows. You just drop it. If there's a desk nearby, table, just set it there. "This is for you. Goodbye." Okay? You have to tell him, "You are being sued." Okay? And then you write up a little report saying who it was that you served him personally, date, time, place. Okay? And then you file that proof of service back with the court. And that proof of service form that you fill out is part of the summons. Your copy of the summons. Okay, so that's how you serve a person. Like I said, it can be a friend can do it. You can have the sheriff do it. They charge $25 or so, something like that, to do it, I think. You can have a process server do it. They typically charge $50. Okay, depends on how far they have to travel and how much time it takes. But that's how you serve a person, the basic service. So that's called service. Now there's another technique called substitution of service. You can't find the person. Okay? You go to his place of work, you can't get him face to face. Alright, he's hiding back there. Or he's at home, only he won't come to the door. Somebody else comes to the door. Whoever you're dealing with, if you're dealing with somebody at home, you want that person to be responsible. Again, you don't do it personally. You have a friend or process server do it. They go to the door. Somebody answers the door. "This is a lawsuit for Joe Blow." Okay? Okay, they either take it or they don't. If they don't want to take it, just drop it on the floor and go. Okay? But if they take it, fine. And most people do take it. I've never had a real problem with that. Then, after you give it to them, you get the name of the person if you can. If you can't get the name, you just say, okay, time of day, place, 5'2", eyes of blue, you know, brown hair, whatever. Describe the person. This is who, that was who answered the door. You don't have to know the name. It's nice to get the name, but you don't have to. They just give you a first name, that's fine too. But you know, whatever. Then you leave there and you mail a copy to the same address to the person being served. So you have a two-pronged approach. So because it's two-pronged, it's deemed to be as reliable as a direct service. Okay? In the case of serving at their place of work, it's the same thing, except you have to deal with the person who's apparently in charge of the office. Got that? Apparently in charge. You walk up. They're not going to let you in the plant if it's a big company, right? They're not going to just let you walk in.
It'll be like the security, office.
Whoever it is, you say, "I've got a lawsuit. I got to serve this." Well, you can't go in. Okay. Okay. So you're the one that you're stopping me, right? Right. You can't go in. Okay. You give it to him. You get his name. If you can't get his name, get his description or something, date, time, whatever. So you know to narrow it down who it was. Kind of like you do at the home. But you want the person who's the gatekeeper, who's stopping you. If you're trying to serve, let's say, the warden in a prison, they'll stop you right at the gate. You just give it with the guard. He's the one apparently in charge. If he won't let you, if you say, "Well, I'd like to speak to your commanding officer," he says no. Well, obviously he's in charge, isn't he? You give it to him. You're responsible. Okay? In the case of where we served the district attorney, we didn't know who signed the complaint. So we got a hold of a person, somebody, we got to the secretary, who said, "We want to serve one of the DAs with this." So who do you want to serve? Well, we don't know, but we can't read his name. So they called somebody. The person came out. That person knew who it was, but wouldn't tell us. Said, if you want to know, you have to get it on discovery. Well, okay, well, what's your name? All right, we got her name. So he said, okay, well, here's the paper. We're leaving it in your hands to deliver it to him. Because she wouldn't let us go back through, wouldn't let us in. Then
that's
we mailed.
That's cool with the DA. DA, you're an officer of the court and you've been given a court's
command. So it has nothing to do with being officer of the court. It has to do only with the fact that this is the person apparently in charge of the office.
Okay?
Forget the DA stuff. It's just, he works there and this person's stopping me from going in. Obviously, that's the person in charge. They made the decision. If they weren't in charge, they'd go get the person who is in charge and have them say no. All right? So it's the person apparently in charge. You don't have to know they're in charge, just apparently in charge. We got her business card. Thank you very much. Please give it to Complainer Doe. For all we know, that we were talking to Complainer Doe. We didn't know. But in our subsequent court papers, well, first of all, we mailed a second copy to the defendant, care of that specific person. Okay, so we had them on the hook, and that may eventually turn out to be Complainer Doe, just wouldn't admit it. So, in any case...
Oh, once you send it through the mail, if it doesn't get to them, that's mail fraud, isn't it?
No, I don't know about that. All I'm pointing out is that that's a whole new issue in a different court. That's a federal court item. All I know is we served them. Okay? For purposes of our existing lawsuit, we served them. Don't get distracted by these side issues. So, anyway, that's the second method. That's called substitution of service. Now, there's a third method, and that is that you can try to find the person. You can't find them. So you file with the court a due diligence report. And what you do is you basically write a letter to the court, and you title it due diligence report, okay? And you say on there, here's what I did to try and find this guy, and I couldn't find him. So there's your due diligence. And then you request of the court permission, and you do this with a motion. Okay? The due diligence, by the way, that's an affidavit. All facts are brought into the court through affidavits. So you say to the court on paper, in your motion, you request permission to serve by publication. And if you get the permission of the court, you then go to a newspaper of general circulation and you just ask the newspaper, are you a newspaper of general circulation? They'll tell you yay or nay, because that's a recognition from the state, okay? And if they are, then, and they always have a price and they'll publish it for 4 weeks, something like that, and basically they put in the information, the name of the person, his last known address or something, and he's being sued, and here's the case number, and so forth. So you serve them publicly. Okay, so that's another method. And then when they're finished publication, they'll return to you a certificate of publication which you file with the court, and that's the proof you serve them by publication. It's his responsibility to read the newspaper. Okay? Now, another method of serving is you know he's at home, but he won't answer the door. When he won't answer the door, you go back to the court. Same deal. You make an affidavit of your due diligence, and then you say to the court, or you make a motion to the court, asking that the court grant the authority to have the sheriff break the door down and serve him. Okay? And if the court grants it, which if you have a good due diligence report showing that he really, why it is you think he's home, his car's parked in front, you see him go in but you couldn't get there in time to, he won't answer the door, you know, you have to provide some evidence that's convincing. But if the court's convinced that this guy is just some clown trying to hide from service, they'll authorize the sheriff to break the door down and go in after him and serve him. Okay? Now, another method of serving is, let's say you know his address, okay, but you just can't make contact with him, but you know his address. So you go back to the court. All this stuff is done with a motion. All motions are simply a request to the court to authorize something, okay? And so you say to the court what your facts are, your efforts to serve this person, and you request that the clerk serve. The court authorizes the clerk, or maybe you can just go directly to the clerk.